Thank you for the invitation to be here. And may I say that I'm looking forward actually to the second part more than the first part. I'm looking forward to the engagement with yourselves as theological reflectors on some of these issues that I think we are all struggling with today. And I simply stand before you as one who, at this stage in my own ministerial journey, has committed myself to a journey of not knowing. That's my self-description of where I'm at. I think we are in a very particular phase of our cultural evolution, and in terms of patterns of response of church, and the knowledge that I might have had seems to me not be terribly helpful to what we might be facing. So I commit myself to that journey of not knowing, and I look forward to being informed by your responses to what I have to say. And the other thing is to say that I usually, if I'm speaking, I tend to operate with a PowerPoint presentation and operate without the written script in front, but I felt that this topic required a much more kind of disciplined attention, and so I will be reading more than I would normally do, but I know that you're folks who are well up for following that kind of presentation. Beyond the Congregation, a Christian Community for Today's Searchers was the title that I gave to David when he asked me. I want to share with you, first of all, three trigger points for me for this reflection. Sometimes you stumble on a phrase or a sentence which spins your mind out of its usual orbit. James Hopewell's magisterial work on congregation stories and structures did that for me. One sentence stood out rather awkwardly from the main theme. It was as though I'd been walking on the beach and stubbed my toe on an invisible rock. The sentence was this: common as they are in several religious traditions, congregations have never dominated the totality of the world's religious organizations. The congregation is not as inevitable as church members might assume. Now, for one who had grown up in a congregation, ministered in congregations, encouraged and consulted with congregations, and was part of a denomination and a nation which equates the local expression of church with the language of congregation, this sentence made me realize that I was living within a cultural cage. Congregation was not the only way of being church. Every time we use the word congregation, we import a whole culture of assumptions about the way that church life will be expressed, from the physicality of buildings, seating and pulpits, to the patterns of membership, belonging and participation in worship and service, through to the assumed roles of leadership, whatever names are given to the professional or voluntary leadership groups. Hopewell's book is a brilliant plea for a patient understanding of congregations, whom he describes as, and I love this, a thick gathering. And who over time have woven together an intricate web of significance. And this is how he describes a congregation: a group that possesses a special name and recognizes members who assemble regularly to celebrate a more universally practiced worship, but to communicate with each other sufficiently to develop intrinsic patterns of conduct, worship, and story. Now, while his book alerted me to the profound issues of identity that must be respected and understood if we're to adapt and adjust our congregations for the missionary challenges of a postmodern and post-Christendom era, that distinctive and disruptive sentence that I quoted earlier opened my mind to the fact that the congregation is itself a culture-bound model of Christian community. Perhaps the reconfiguration of our culture may require more than an adjustment of the congregational model. Perhaps it requires alternatives, parallel structures, complementary models, multifaceted expressions of Christian community that can inhabit the multi-layered networks of our decentered culture. Our culture has been described as a spiritual centrifuge. That is, an apparatus that rotates at such tremendous velocity that existing densities break up as new densities emerge. We live at a time when the task of leading a congregation is becoming old technology. The task of the coming decades is learning how to build Christian communities in many different forms. In times of profound change, the learners inherit the earth, it has been said, while the learned find themselves beautifully equipped to deal with the world that no longer exists. First trigger point. Second trigger point. 5 years on from reading Hopewell, I came across the writings of James Thwaites, The Church Beyond the Congregation, in which he presses the case even further. Thwaites' thesis is that Western theology and ecclesiology have been affected by Greek dualism that divides spirit from body and sacred from secular. He claims that this has led to an overemphasis on the congregational gathering point as the focus of our time and our energy. He calls for a Hebrew view of life where we're released from inherited mindsets into a re-evaluation of our present congregation-focused approach to church life. He traces that dualistic spirit split through Plato and Aquinas and the rationalism of the Reformation and onto the Enlightenment and the Age of Reason. He then identifies how we embody the split in the use of our buildings. He points out that the early church had no public church buildings until Constantine used pagan temples as the base for Christianity as the imperial religion. He claims that buildings are a handicap. I quote, "In a postmodern time, it is becoming more and more obvious that the Christian split universe, mostly expressed in and from a building we have named church, is benefiting the saints less and less. It is not attracting the attention of the unchurched tribes, heading into the diverse and desperate postmodern mosaic of the 21st century. I believe," he says, "that our focus for divine meaning and mission on the church gathered is a major strategic error on the part of the Christian church. It must be overcome if we, as the body of Christ, are to enter into and impact a postmodern world. The Greek split has triumphed by detaching the church from most of the saints' life and work in creation. The reality we face at this time is that a kingdom divided cannot stand. Divided cannot act, and so a church divided cannot build." End of quote. Thwaites suggests that we heal this split universe by listening to the voice of the Spirit in creation. Based on the image in Romans 8 of the creation groaning and waiting for the liberation of the children of God, he argues that the church finds its true identity when we hear creation's cry and are released to respond. The world will know the church when the cry is answered by the people of God as we move out from our buildings into what the Puritans called the various spheres of creation. Unfortunately, he says, we continue to listen mostly to our own voices echoing off the walls, defining and redefining us again and again, and we're left wondering why the people don't come. I can say that particular sentence meant something very particular to me. It's one of the reasons that I left St. Ninian's. I was fed up listening to the same stuff being recycled in all the conferences that I attended or even led. And it seemed to me that we were listening to the same things, being given different language, but we weren't breaking out of our cultural captivity. And only Cornelius could offer that to Peter. And I suspected that my Cornelius lay elsewhere. He then goes on to say, "It is time to look again and locate the new people in Christ that make up the church. It is time to release them from their church containment set in place by the Greeks and send them into God's creation that to this day still knows and calls their name." Interesting imagery. The third trigger. That's Hopewell. That's Thwaites. Now, let me introduce you to The Flight of the Raven. Between reading Hopewell and Thwaites came a watershed experience of ministry in the centre of Edinburgh, based in the parish church of St Cuthbert, where I was given the mandate to develop appropriate mission strategies for that part of the city centre. which turned out to be a mix of residents, businesses, homeless people, and the entertainment industry. Each of them needed a distinct form of Christian community dispersed around the central hub of the Mother Church. Hopewell had alerted me to the need to explore other options beyond the congregation. Thwaites read after I had done this, allowed me a lens to look back and read a map of what had been an uncharted journey. We had been answering a call of the Spirit in creation to become disembedded from a congregational model and to learn how to embed communities of faith in the various spheres of the life of the city. The most challenging and radical of these journeys was our exploration of church for the club culture. That forced me to tear up all my mental maps of congregational experience in order to ask what church might look like for these young people who found in the clubs the experience of transcendence through the music and a community of intimacy in the friendships of the clubbing scene. People who processed communication electronically, sonically, and bodily, for whom community life was active rather than passive, and for whom democratic participation was their mode of relating and making decisions. We moved through three phases over a period of 8 years. There was the project phase, then a phase of living as a community, and then a period of dispersal. The first phase explored patterns of worship in pubs and clubs which mirrored the dynamics of nightclub life, dance worship with DJs and visuals representing the dance floor of the club, and then other contemplative worship reflecting the club's chill-out room. We explored the Celtic monastic tradition for rhythms of prayer and wholesome living, and generally wrestled with people who had been deeply damaged by church life, which had suppressed their questions and given little space for their creativity. Beyond the project phase, a small community of Christians formed called the Raven Community, based in a flat in Lothian Road, with a weekly rhythm of meals and worship, of prayers and personal involvement in some of the challenging areas of city life, some dealing with refugees, some involved in sexual health, some looking at the legal issues related to prostitution. The flat became one of Edinburgh's boiler rooms, where 24/7 prayer was focused for particular seasons of the year. Migration, illness, lack of funding, dispersal of key individuals, and the sale of the flat meant that the Ravens flew the nest by 2005. Looking back, it's not clear that the community of Christians maybe became a Christian community in a fully cohesive sense. That remains one of the areas to be explored further in the light of the many new models of community which are appearing around the country and across the post-Christendom Western world. The intentionally missional community became more of a therapeutic community for people struggling to recover lost faith or to redefine it. It was an honest community, often painfully honest, but was much to be preferred to the superficial politeness of much congregational politics. We were only at the edge of something, but we did touch the hem of Christ's garment, and some were healed. It's been said that we learn most on the border of order and chaos. This period was a time of living in what Victor Turner, the anthropologist, calls liminality, living through a threshold moment, a transition from one phase of life to another. In such a time, we need what he calls communitas, a form of supportive community that facilitates transition from one stage of life to another, from one phase of faith to another, from one cultural period to another. We had hoped for a church that would be marked by permanence, and found we had simply offered a community for a period of transition. We struggled with issues of leadership as we found previous experiences not translating easily to the new context, perhaps being more diffident than we needed to be. Before we had the language, we had experienced communitas, and perhaps stumbled on a pattern of Christian community that is essential for today's spiritual searchers. So let me move now from these three trigger areas to some description of today's spiritual searchers that we want to engage with. Let me say a word about the spiritual search around us. In Edinburgh summer school in 2005, John Drain, who of course has researched and written so much in this theme, was leading a summer school for doctoral students for Columbia Seminary. And within that, John suggested that the spiritual search today could be grouped into three categories. First of all, those in search of a more disciplined spiritual life, whether through Buddhist meditation or Ignatian exercises or the rise of new monasticism. We only need to look at the extraordinary response to the BBC reality TV show on the monastery, generating massive interest in the monastic life of prayer and a search for depth in our superficial culture, to realise that this is true. So many people are suffering from the disease of affluenza, described as a contagious middle-class virus causing depression, anxiety, addiction and ennui. There are various groups exploring this kind of approach, such as the community of Aidan and Hilda, based in Lindisfarne, who describe themselves as a worldwide pilgrim people, reconnecting with the spirit and the scriptures, the saints and the streets, the seasons and the soil. Second group that John mentions are those who are simply looking for common sense wisdom for everyday living. These would include the self-help books, the growing industry of life coaching, the fascination for personality profiling. Now, my wife does life coaching, personality profiling, and spiritual direction. And she has around 15 people at the moment meeting with her on a regular basis, usually in cafes and hotels, many of them finding that church life does not touch their deep questioning or spiritual search for identity and their new paths for spiritual growth at particular stages in their life. The third group that John mentioned were those who are into what might call the more bizarre aspects of popular spirituality, from crystals to tarot cards, from astrology to astrology and spiritual auras. Now, much of the popularity of that is down to good marketing and gullibility. Nonetheless, behind the New Age search is a genuine quest. Rob Frost, Methodist evangelist of 30 years' experience, has published the book A Closer Look at New Age Spirituality. He opens with these words, quote, "For too long, the church has seen the New Age movement as a threat, an enemy, and a source of evil in the world. I began to write this book as a diatribe of Bible verses and theology condemning it. I repent. Since meeting some of those involved in New Age activity, hanging around their bookstalls and fairs and hearing them talk of their genuine quest for reality, I've changed my perspective. Now I'm asking, what can I learn from the emerging New Age spirituality? What can it teach me? How can it help me?" A number of Christians are now finding ways of being present in the psychic fairs to offer a Christian presence. Listening posts, prayer for healing, the meaning of tarot, explaining the scriptural images that are on the tarot cards, foot massage and prayer, interpretation of dreams, and I like this one, psalm reading. You can see how the people get mixed up with that one. And so when people turn up what they think is the palm reading, they're asked to choose a number between 1 and 150. And they're surprised at what they learn. You'll be delighted to know they're onto the Psalms, Fergus. In the light of our question about the nature of spiritual community for spiritual searchers, we have to ask how far the congregational model helps those who are looking for a more disciplined spiritual life, those who are looking for accountability groups to apply the practical wisdom tradition of Scripture as God's guidance to everyday living, or how it begins to connect with a spiritual tourist who needs gentle guidance and a soul friend to become a pilgrim in search of Christ. In a recent seminar at the University of Glasgow, Dr. Eric Stoddart of St Andrews University introduced some of his ongoing research into spirituality in Scotland through examining the Scottish Social Attitude Survey of 2001. I hesitate to use this because it is a work in progress and I'm not sure that I understood it all. But a number of relevant themes emerged from the presentation and discussion that I think are pertinent to this conversation. This research is an attempt to reach behind the usual reading of the spiritual temperature in Scotland through church affiliation, and to look instead at attitudes to spirituality and levels of spiritual awareness. The survey asked questions related to, first of all, the impact that religious practice had on daily life. Secondly, the range of other spiritual practices that people had engaged in. And thirdly, the level of awareness that people had of spiritual influence. Only 20% said that religious affiliation affected their lives to a significant degree. 55% were engaging in some other form of spiritual practice, from astrology to horoscopes or whatever, and 75% displayed some awareness of a spiritual dimension in life, a spiritual hunger out there. Eric was working on a formula that pulled all the data together into a composite spirituality scale. I love these people that can work with numbers. In which 35% of respondents emerged as very low. And in relation to our issue about congregation and community, 33% of those in the very low category were Presbyterian. I think this underlines the disjunction between our inherited models of congregational life and the spiritual quest in Scotland today. Paul Healis and Linda Woodhead are authors of the book The Spiritual Revolution, Why Religion is Giving Way to Spirituality. Based on research in Kendal, their thesis is that there's a movement in our culture from life as, in inverted commas, religion, that is, life as wife or mother, life as doctor or minister, life as a member of the church, where roles are given and understood by conventions of society, to, inverted commas, subjectivity, where we operate by feeling and intuition. Their study divided the spiritual quest into congregational mode of the search and holistic milieu mode. That was their approach to the broader, vaguer spirituality. They discovered that 7.9% of people expressed their spirituality in congregational mode and 1.6% in holistic milieu mode. These figures were small. The immediate conclusion is that the spiritual revolution has not yet occurred. The congregation seems still to be holding the ground, albeit in small scale. However, at a lecture in New College in April 2005, Professor Healis made the prediction that with the rate of decline of congregational life in UK and the rise of spiritual quest, he expects that by 2025 the holistic milieu will overtake the congregational model. If the congregational mode reduces by half to 3.9% and the holistic milieu doubles to 3.2%, you begin to see you're moving towards a crossover point by 2025. If. Since he's basing his figures in England, and we usually fall about 10 to 15 years behind England and Scotland in terms of culture shift, then we may expect the same change of focus around 2035, 40. Once again, we're challenged, I think, by this simply not to place all our spiritual eggs in the congregational basket. That's the point I'm making. Now, add to that prediction the stark observation by Stuart Murray that we're losing many people through the back door of our churches. A recent estimate, he says, is that 1 million Christians no longer belong to churches, and that's the fastest growing part of the Christian community. The New Zealander, Alan Jimison, in his research into post-church groups, reveals that these groups are made up of people in midlife, average age 40 to 45, married with families and typically well-educated. High percentages had been in leadership roles in the church, and the reasons for leaving were related to two areas. One, the structure and orientation of churches, the shallowness of format, manipulative or controlling leadership, personal burnout. And secondly, the need for space for personal and spiritual growth. For example, the church was like a stuck record. I recognise that. Too narrow and cutting them off from ordinary people. Jimison argues that we are seeing people move through various stages of faith, such as those described by James Fowler. This same movement has been described by David Lyle in Integrity of Pastoral Care, where people move beyond the conformist conventional faith to an invigorative, reflective faith, and then on to a conjunctive faith where we can live more easily with the paradoxes and ambiguities of life. Lyle sees this being consistent with our cultural movements from pre-modern to modern to post-modern. And Jimison goes further to use this progression as a clue to the elements of community life which will nurture and sustain people on their journey. These are the spiritual searchers. In the midst of these explorations and these cultural adaptations, where are our theological pointers or anchor points? A Christian community is called to reflect the image of God, the God we worship, trust, serve, and to whom we bear witness in Jesus Christ, God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The Church of Scotland report on Church Without Walls offered a very simple descriptor of church, taken from the stories of the Gospels. People with Jesus at the centre, travelling where Jesus takes us, quote unquote. People with Jesus at the centre, travelling where Jesus takes us. May not be sufficiently sophisticated for some theologians, but it does have the virtue of affirming the core identity of Christian community and dislodging a settled church into its destiny as a movement to the ends of the earth and the end of time, as Newbegin reminds us. In theological shorthand, we are called to a Christological embodiment of the Missio Dei. Church Without Walls suggested that churches be shaped by four elements: by the Gospels, by our context, by friendship, and by the gifts of God's people. Interestingly, recent research by Eddie Gibbs and Ryan Bolger on new patterns of church in UK and USA show that across a spectrum of 50 new communities, there is a primary focus on identifying with Jesus, a return to the Gospels as the measure of personal and community life. Of course, each gospel has a different perspective, and each gospel writer would shape a community differently. From my observation, most congregations would choose the Matthew's mould, rooted in history, orderly, with strong issues of legalism running through it, but finally capable of being liberated into disciple-making mission. Many of the new communities, however, would align, it seems to me, more closely with one of the other Gospels, with Mark, the activist, with the questioning disciples as confused as the end as at the beginning, with Luke, the charismatic, spirit-alert adventurer concerned about including the outsiders and challenging attitudes to wealth and poverty, or with John, focused in a ministry of incarnation. The Word became a human being and moved into the neighbourhood, as the Message translates it, recognising signs of God at a wedding or a funeral, and encouraging more of a contemplative, reflective community. Jesus at the centre, travelling where Jesus takes us. Or to be shaped by our context, both local and cultural, is an invitation to earth our following of Jesus in the neighbourhoods and networks where we live, work, or play, so that we transform secular space by reclaiming God's world in the name of God's kingdom. When this engagement is combined with a commitment to the kenotic ministry of Christ in Philippians, who makes himself as nothing to become a servant, and the cosmic ministry of Christ of Colossians, by whom, through whom, and for whom all things were created, then we're released from the ecclesiastical agoraphobia and paranoia that erode our missionary confidence. Jesus at the centre, travelling where Jesus takes us. Friendship is a key word in the Church Without Walls report and is a key word in all the literature about postmodern Christian community. It includes a spirit of hospitality to the stranger, a quality of community life marked by authenticity, honesty, and generosity, as well as Christian witness and discipleship through faith accompaniment and as a fellow traveller on the way, with a capital W. This kind of friendship is rooted in Jesus' words in John 15 about calling his disciples friends rather than servants, giving to them all that the Father has given to him, and laying down his life for them. Jesus at the centre, and travelling where Jesus takes us. The final Church Without Walls shaper is shaped by the gifts of God's people. Each of us is a gift from God to be given away to the world. So much church life is about finding people to plug the gaps in our ecclesiastical systems and to shore up what is struggling to survive. The New Testament speaks of many gifts being given so that we can be the multi-gifted body of Christ. Representing Christ, representing Christ in the world. When we listen to the dreams and the passions of people, we will be surprised at the gifts that God has planted in them by his Spirit. God is not caught out by our particular phase of history. He has already given the gifts that are needed for the work that he wants to be done. Gibbs and Bolger discover an immense range of creative gifts being released generously in these new communities, a desire to be producers rather than consumers, and patterns of leadership that allowed people to have a voice in the process of discernment about the future shape of the community. The parallels, therefore, between what Church Without Walls was saying in 2001 and what Bolger and Gibbs are saying in 2004 and 2005 are remarkably similar. Recently, I met a young man who has a passion to connect with the punks and goths in the alternative cultures of our cities. His love for their music came when he was converted. Up till then, he didn't even like the music, but the Spirit of Jesus did. We are his body. He has given us more gifts for mission than we know. Jesus at the centre, travelling where Jesus takes us. These few theological pointers don't amount to a fully worked out ecclesiology, as you well know, but they do allow us to respond to the call to follow Christ. Perhaps this is a time to travel light rather than not travel at all. And so to some indicators of contours of community. As we travel into our post-Christendom world, Christian community beyond the congregation will require to attend to three contours of community life. One, we will require to explore patterns of Christian spirituality that recover contemplation, question, and the mystery of silence, offsetting our inherited tendency to wordiness and offering tidily ticked boxes of answers. It has been said that Jesus was asked 183 questions and only gave direct answers to three of them. I'll leave that to somebody else to check out, but I read that recently. There will be a clear practical focus on the Jesus of the Gospels and aiming to live faithfully as his followers amidst the realities and ambiguities of our time. We will see worship that will be decentered from a single dominant leader and become multi-voiced, leaving space for interaction and dialogue around the Word of God. The art of storytelling will be recovered, and there will be a reimagination of the sacraments of baptism and communion as multi-sensory occasions shaped by creative liturgists who can use the symbols and communication skills of our time. We will need Emmaus Road evangelists who walk alongside the questioners, hear the pain, and set the mess of life in the mystery and meaning of the messianic story, offering searchers the hospitality of the supper table where the risen Christ reveals himself. Sanctus One in Manchester has been exploring these themes and has developed a significant presence in the centre of the city for people in that spiritual search. Contacts are mainly de-churched people aged 20 to 40, young postmodern professionals working in the arts, attempting something new because they've been hurt by church. They stay because of community, inclusiveness, creativity, and sacred space for reflection. Sanctus 2 is on the second Sunday of the month and is intergenerational, with a cafe, prayer, film, and creative space. And they join with others for Nexus, that operates a night cafe between 2 and 4 a.m., offering coffee, chat, film, and the arts for the night population of the city. So the first contour is exploring patterns of Christian spirituality. The second contour we will require to express authentic Christian community that is honest and healthy, living out the courageous integrity of grace and truth. We'll be clear about our centre in Christ, but we'll allow for a movement of people around him like the ebb and flow of gospel crowds. Some committed disciples and other curious observers up trees or elsewhere. Investors and consumers, if you like. Community life will require to be simple but sustainable. I quote Stuart Murray. Jimison suggests the need to offer support to move through James Fowler's fifth conjunctive stage of faith and uses the fascinating imagery of dual parentage, drawing from Mother Church, the full Christian tradition of scripture and church history, and learning from Father Culture, the symbols, language, and media of today. Leonard Sweet would describe such a culturally connected community as epic. E for experiential, P for participatory, I for image-based, and C for connected, communal, epic. The dual parentage image is similar to the ideas you find in the mission-shaped church of double listening to gospel and culture, and the ancient future faith that, again, Sweet speaks of, which recognises that the call to incarnation involves marrying transcendence and immanence. Coracle. Coracle is a small community in Edinburgh led by two Episcopal priests within a particular independent trust. It began as a young adults group for people in their 20s and 30s and has grown into another example of communitas, basing the rhythm of their life on three phases in the year. Term one is a journey inwards on prayer and spirituality. Second term is the journey outward, learning to live counterculturally in the face of media manipulation, consumerism, and ecological challenge. And the third term is the journey together, reflecting regularly on the health of the relationships in community. When they've been doing that now for almost 4 years, there's extraordinary depth built into that community through that rhythm. The relationships are now spiralling outwards beyond the 20s and 40s as individuals to offer godly play for children and working with young mums, and another group for men exploring male spirituality. You begin to see now this group connecting to all sorts of other sections of the community. The third strand or element of the contour we're looking for is that we will require to engage with society in the slipstream of God's mission of grace to transform people, place, and planet as his kingdom comes. People are looking for a faith that makes a difference, and they're open to joining hands with allies of goodwill who are working for a more just, equitable, peaceful, and sustainable world. There is impatience with religious divisions which create congregational competitiveness, duplication, and the self-absorbed use of resources. Over the past year, 30 or 40 people in their 20s and 30s have met on four occasions for Dream Days, where people share their dreams of influencing the city of Edinburgh for the sake of the kingdom of God. These dreams include work among the Goths, to prayer networks, film production that teases people about city life and its issues, and a group of girls who have moved into one of the poorest areas of the city is offering nutrition classes and dressmaking skills to young mums. And one of the stories I do love from that little group is one girl who believed she was being asked to walk with God, and wondering what that meant, she then discovered that the health centre was looking for people who would walk with elderly people or would go out with mums who had too many kids to look after and walk with them. She's learned what walking with God means in that community. These people who gather for the Dream Days find they're not supported by the congregations that they have association with or had association with, because some have now become disconnected. And so they need some other kind of network of support and some kind of spiritual framework to help them understand their sense of vocation. They resonate with James Thwaite's invitation to find their vocation in God's creation rather than in a congregation which saps time and energy into being self-sustaining. They respond best to questions rather than solutions. They need older heads to come alongside and listen, encourage and affirm. They need to be healed of the sacred secular schizophrenia and be given confidence to move into God's world and meet Christ in the streets. These people are now my companions on the way. I am apprenticing myself to their dreams. I'm learning to be a learner, learning to be a beginner again, a follower rather than a leader. Always asking the question about how we might wrap supportive and challenging Christian community around these dreamers. What spiritual disciplines will sustain them for their journey? Many of them are below the radar of most church statistics and church strategies, but they're inhabiting a new cultural landscape as searchers, as dreamers, and activists, speaking of a new Galilee where the risen Christ is ahead of us, waiting for his disciples to meet up with him. And so I stand at the door of my congregation. An angel meets me and says, "Don't be alarmed. You're looking for Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. But go. Tell his disciples and Peter he's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you'll see him just as he told you." Of course, we continue to meet the risen Christ in our congregations. But many do not. And he's moving on to meet them where they are. It's time to go.
Thank you, Peter. Not time for you to do quite yet. Well, it's over to us now to come with some questions or reactions to what Peter has said. So the floor is open.
I like your definition of people with Jesus at the centre, travelling where Jesus takes us. That sounds like a church to me.
That's right.
Mm. So how, if that was the church without walls, how does the church with walls differ from it?
Being stuck. Being settled church and settled community. Mm-hmm. I think we have inherited through our Christendom context this, and we tend to be settled church and settled in settled community. And what we're being caught out by is the fluidity of our culture, both in terms of the physical mobility and then also, I think, the other changes in terms of cultural movement. Therefore, I think the reason for stating it in that particular way was to emphasize the sense that when Jesus gathered his people, it was essentially a movement that he was gathering, and we have somehow managed to become rather embedded, which all the business of buildings and organization and so on exemplify in very particular ways. I'm aware, of course, that there are congregations out of which missionary movement happens, and I recognize that. But that's essentially the description, is to sum up what I think are the core elements of the centre of what we're operating in, and then the circumference to which we're called.
So how would you speak to a congregation about the fact that if Jesus is at the centre, presumably they can't stay where they are? What are they doing that stifles Jesus?
I think that's what the workshop will talk about this afternoon. I hope you'll answer that for me. I think we seem to have settled in a lot of our congregational life for kind of secondary identities, mm-hmm. Stanley Jones. He said that throughout the church we have developed a pattern of talking about Jesus and You know, Jesus and baptism, Jesus and our congregational model, Jesus and our ministerial patterns, Jesus and speaking in tongues, Jesus and the and becomes more important than Jesus. And so we end up with secondary identities. And I think that that is one of the I think that therefore that in a sense is an idolatry when you take it to its ultimate position. And to draw people right back and saying, if we said all we're going to do was to live with this Jesus represented to us and say, what would our lives look like following him and being on the move with him? I think we'd begin to dispose of quite a lot of what we actually do. I was in company with somebody the other day, and I put this to you, this is somebody who would go as far as to say that, and it's really taking something of what the James Thwaites thing about emphasising the gathering over much. This person would say it's almost like we need to think in terms of crop rotation. There are times in the life of the church over history when we have required, in a sense, that emphasis on the kind of gathering and the nurturing and teaching. But he would say that we are now in a stage where we almost need to kind of lay that behind us and say some of us have actually had about as much teaching as we can take, to be honest. And the issue is now, what will we do with it? And just go and get on. And then there'll come points where we may need to come back and do further reflection and re-energising, you know, for the journey. But actually, we're pretty well fueled up, to be honest. It's just that we're not going anywhere. And I think we need to get that moving metaphor for people. I don't know if other people resonate with that, but that's my experience of things. Yes,
I find much of what you say very stimulating in terms of evangelism. I think it's a necessary stimulus. But if you're talking about secondary identities in terms of ecclesiology, if it's a gathering of clubbers or people who are in their 20s,
sure.
You already have a secondary identity there that is in danger of becoming being made primary.
Sure.
And therefore the fact that you say that the grouping you were involved in was transitional, I wonder if that, by definition, these groupings are transitional for those who are involved in them. And really there has to be something further where there's a breaking down of those barriers for them, which is their own cultural identity, into Christ being their identity, so that they can relate to people from other sectors, older people over 40, for example.
I think that's an important observation, and there's no doubt that what I asked some of the young folk what they would value, and they said we'd like some older people to invest in us, and I said, well, I do. What I found myself doing actually every Wednesday night at 5 o'clock for about 4 years was actually meeting with two of those young folk. In their 20s, and just meeting with them at 5 o'clock, either in a cafe or a pub, wherever they chose, and we would the only question we ever asked was, "What's been happening this week?" That was all, and you travelled the world, you know, with that question actually. These were very stimulating times for me, and in some ways, that's all it takes, and it's not talking about organising something very special. But just that availability and vulnerability and kind of sticking with it over a period is what makes a difference. And I this is why I come back. There are certain simplicities, I think, that we're missing. To then take your next point about moving, I think we'd still need this word communitas, however, you know, whatever it is about, does give us another language just for saying there's a need for transitional spaces for people. And I think we have tended to think in terms of permanence about the nature of church and to offer those transitional places, not expect them to be the place where people stay, but they move on as important. But I think when I look at where some of the people have gone from that group, and some have gone overseas, I mean, they've gone to do all sorts of other things in other parts of the world. Some have moved on, have gone to other churches of a very different tradition from where they started out. And I think we need to be a little more generous about that, to recognise that there will be at different stages of people's lives different parts of the Christian church that will best be equipped out of their tradition to nurture that stage of the journey. My wife finds Church of Scotland very difficult now. She is much happier in an Episcopal context, for instance, and elements of the liturgy and particularly the Eucharist that she finds just touch her in a place that my best preaching never does. I do not understand it. So I suppose I'm recognising that sense of that we do have a multiplicity of communities already historically embedded in some ways, and we need to draw on some of that. But even that, there's still too much in some of the power dynamics of that that are difficult for a lot of our postmodern folks to buy into. And it's often the power issue that is at the heart of that.
Sorry,
David and Shelley, yes.
You said at one point, Peter, that the heart of what you were saying was the challenge not to put all our eggs in the congregational basket. But I felt there was a tension between that and well, the title of the talk, really, Beyond the Congregation. So it, the eggs that go into the congregational basket, are they in terms of sustaining what already exists and enabling it to make the transition?
I think what I was wanting to arrive at, maybe it wasn't clear enough, that if we get to the middle of this century, I don't think that the congregational model will be as dominant or as preeminent as it has been in the past century. That's what I'm saying. I think there will be a multiplicity of Christian communities around. I think there will be, using the centrifuge image, I think the densities will change. I think there will be some congregations that will sufficiently transition for our culture to become resource congregations. And we will not see our denominational centres as the place where we'll be resourced from. I'm thinking from a denominational base, and not all of us operate from that, but I do, and I tend to think of, you know, the church operating from the centre. We are becoming increasingly decentred. I can think of, I'll be specific, I think of St Andrew's in Bowness, where Albert Bogle has developed multimedia approaches to worship, and he is resourcing literally scores of congregations around the country on that particular thing. I can think of a church in Glasgow in White Inch that's been developing church planting. They are developing their Invest course. That will become a resource church to others. There is a church in Giffnock that will host the Missional Leaders course for Together in Mission. That will be a resource church. There is a church in Aberdeen, I'm sure, will again in Old Macher, that again will become a resource church to others. And I think we'll see the densities changing, and much of what the institution has been reluctant to take on board will be taken on board by those local agencies. I now think institutions cannot be proactive. I think that only bodies such as that can be proactive enough to make the move, and once it's safe, the institution will wrap itself around it. So we need to release that to happen. So there will be congregational presence, but it will be different, and it will have a different function. And then there will be a range of other patterns of Christian community around those that may have to draw to them from time to time and still draw on those congregational spaces for additional support. It will not be as homogeneous as once it was. And again, if I speak from a Church of Scotland perspective, in the 1950s, you could possibly have gone from, you know, Caithness to Stranraer and walked in and out of a Church of Scotland congregation, and you would have seen pretty much the same thing happening and heard the same stuff sung and the same stuff said in the same, exactly the same way, same pattern in most of those places. Now, you can't do that. Already the congregational pattern would be different. I'm just saying, I think it will go further than that, both in terms of larger and smaller. So I don't know if that answers your question or touches it. Shirley, I think you were going to ask for something.
I think it's kind of moved on a bit in the discussion, but I was thinking about your talk about Edinburgh. I'm thinking that in many ways a city develops nowadays its own ecclesiology because you've got choice.
Yep.
You've got many other options for young people, for example. And they can interact with more traditional church, but join a group like Coracle.
Mm-hmm.
You can be, you know, those circles can come mm-hmm. together. But say you go to a wee village or mm-hmm. you know, there's only one denomination, one church,
mm-hmm.
and you're wanting to move on with Jesus, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Follow where he's going.
Mm-hmm.
And you're very frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
Very maybe this is your workshop material, I don't know. But can you apply the same kind of thinking about growth?
Well, I can, yeah.
Can I follow that up?
Yes, please. Yes, and I'll come back to that.
What are the global implications
mm-hmm.
of what you've been saying?
Mm-hmm.
One can see how it applies to trying to be reached in our culture.
Sure, sure.
But the church we're speaking about, the church seen here, is really a small fragment
yes.
of the church worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
The center of gravity now lies elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the implications, not just for the village?
Yeah.
Shirley's talked about,
okay.
but, you know, for the global church.
Okay, let's go micro and then macro, best I can. I'll answer with, I suppose, two stories. I can think of one person who came to me who had taken a very respectful approach to the local church, had been working with, meeting a lot of young families, literally at the school gate, had begun engaging them in conversations that led to quite deep issues related to faith and life. And she went respectfully to the local church and asked for the opportunity to gather those people together and find some kind of, you know, parallel community for them to grow up in. And there was the anxiety that generated meant that she wasn't really allowed to happen. Having asked the permission, she was, you know, unable to proceed without violating that permission, which always, you know, raises the question about asking forgiveness afterwards rather than permission before. But she had tried to do it respectfully. So that was one where she felt really stymied and then had to go and find other routes. The other was a situation that I'm aware of where there was more than one denomination in the village, and this particular lady had found attending and being part of those particular denominational expressions of church unhelpful for her, that's all I can say. And she then, in conversation with a friend, this was after a number of years, about 4 years, invited some friends to join her for what she called a Julian group. It was kind of Julian of Norwich, reflective, contemplative prayer. Started with 4 people, and within a matter of weeks, she had 15. They then said, well, we don't just, you know, meet to kind of contemplate and pray, come out of that. What comes out of that? Well, we're concerned for our environment, and they developed this recycling project that kind of engaged the whole village. And then, of course, they had their own families, and they said, well, why don't we gather from time to time, and maybe we can tell a story, and we can sing a song, and we might pray together. And what have you got? Now, in the meantime, you know, I think there's rather kind of edgy people in the particular local churches. From what I could gather, and I haven't checked this out entirely, but my impression was that it had not been without an attempt to operate in an integrated way, but then had found that there was a resistance. And so in this, without setting it up as anything in particular, but just has been an organic growth. And I suspect that we're going to see that kind of thing happening. And that's where I think the notion of, you know, the question asked at the beginning about people with Jesus at the centre, travelling where Jesus takes them, I think it's an issue of mindset. I mean, a lot of our churches are still, I think, locked into a very fixed place and will need to travel to engage with those questions. Why are the churches of those respective denominations not engaging with that desire for prayer, for goodness sake, a desire for to do something related to, you know, the good of the environment when everyone's talking about it today, and to do something that's a little more family friendly. These don't seem to me to be outrageous things that are actually being done, but they are, the space has not been allowed. So that does happen. So, yeah. On the global front, first thing to say is you're absolutely right. What we're dealing with here is an issue that pertains particularly, I think, to our Western world and the Christendom context that we have inherited. And so we are having to ask ourselves, how do we relate for patterns that have been forged over centuries? How do we readapt those for a world that has changed very remarkably, and we are no longer in the place of dominance that we did have? How do we operate out of a place of weakness rather than out of a place of assumed strength, for instance? So I think it's a very particular issue, but I don't think it's self-contained. I was listening to Ines Varacho, is that his name, from HTC? Last week, South African. Versace, sorry, I couldn't remember. It's Versace, yes, thank you. Well, Innes was speaking about his observations of how, within the African context, one of the reasons for the kind of meshing of the biblical story to the African mindset is, in a sense, you're dealing with a pre-modern worldview meeting a pre-modern worldview. And so that has meshed, and therefore you have the growth that we have at the moment. Just giving his analysis, he was then raising the question, and we didn't know this. There's no reason to say that the African movement will move through the same process that we have gone through of enlightenment and the scientific revolution and so on, and the modernist view, but there is nonetheless an aspiration within many African cultures that might come their way. And what will be the effect of exporting our Western virus, in a sense, into what is still, you know, a young church, which turns the whole thing back round to saying, I think we have a very particular missionary frontier here to say, how do we deal with this, to be able to engage in conversation with folks who are the young church with all their vitality, but may also be very vulnerable to a particular philosophical and sociological virus that might touch them and destroy what is good. And can we go through our particular missionary questions so that we can engage in a conversation that avoids them being blown apart by the stuff that's actually affected us? So that's I don't know if I'm saying that terribly well. People here don't know far more about that than I do. David?
Just add one thing to that, because yes. I think there's a very interesting conversation developing between some people in the States, in the emerging church movement, and Christian leaders in the Southern Hemisphere. Mm. The most notable example, I think, is Brian McLaren in dialogue with, I think he's a Cameroonian theologian, Kenzo Mabiala.
Okay.
But McLaren has also very recently undertaken a tour of quite a number of South American countries in the company of René Badilla.
Oh, René.
And has written some very interesting things about the convergence between the challenge of mission in a postmodern context in the West and post-colonial concerns
right.
in the church in the Southern Hemisphere.
That's the connection.
And the overlap between
yeah,
those.
Yeah, that's the connection. Yeah. Thank you. I think that's very, very, very helpful. And I think that's it lifts your question, David, out of it being as though this is a kind of pocket that we're in. I think it is actually an issue that has got much wider application and concern. But I mean, I know for me, one of the humbling things, as a Presbyterian, was to realise only 3% of the world's Christian population is Presbyterian. It kind of sets us, you know, in perspective a bit when it comes to our kind of sense of Presbyterian is what we've inherited and, you know, imbibed over the years. David.
The other almost contrasting movement that's happening, or that I sense is happening, in Scotland, and I think is parallel elsewhere, in certainly in the UK, is the rise of mega churches that whose pattern still seems to be within a kind of, I don't know if Christian is the right word to say, but very much a congregational, structured, ordered, authoritarian model. I think it was like Destiny in Glasgow, I think they're here as well. Those songs, places like that.
Sure.
And again, the other side of the global picture is the growth of churches that have come from Nigeria and Ghana, in London, in Birmingham, where the focus is on the big central place for meeting and so on. And I just wondered how you felt sort of that impacting on shifts in. I mean, in a sense, these mega churches are everything that congregations like to be. A bit quieter. We want 600 people in our church. Destiny gives.
Yes.
Don't bounce around as much. But you know, that's something quite different. I think.
Yeah. Good.
Kind of community model.
It's interesting, if you go to Destiny here, first of all, I would, if there's a handful of people of my age, that would be all. And also, if there were, I'll not say the numbers, but certainly percentage-wise, I would have said maybe 30. I'm not going to put a percentage on it, but certainly a very large number of them would actually be African that are there. In other words, I find that there is an attraction, you see, which is fitting that cultural mode, where again the authority structure is quite compatible with what people are accustomed to and looking for in terms of leadership. I suppose the other side of it, and I kind of reminded of the, while on the one hand you've got folks who are questioning the power and authority and looking for the flat and the non-hierarchical, there are a lot of people who are very tired of making decisions and are very happy to have a stronger authoritarian lead. And so there is another kind of magnetic pull. A number of years ago, I think, when the whole shepherding thing was very strong in Northern Ireland, someone kind of pointed out that there was an extraordinary number of people who were medics who were associating with those churches. And one suggestion, and others may have comments to make on this, but one suggestion that was made at that time was that, you know, if you're making life and death decisions literally all week, you're very glad to go somewhere where you're not asked to make those kind of decisions at the weekend. You know, it was literally a place to rest from that kind of, you know, hyper responsibility. And so it's just a slightly different dynamic. Interesting one.
I don't know a whole lot about the Destiny thing, but obviously we focus on the big meeting, the mega church, and the congregation at large kind of thing.
Yep.
But actual fact, is it not the fact that every member of Destiny is also a member of a house group? So you don't just have the big and obvious meeting, but you do have that small community.
Sure. And that's, I mean, that's the other element, where you have your kind of cell and your celebration kind of working together, and then with kind of larger clusters that are maybe gathered for more task-oriented enterprise. And there are churches, for instance, St Thomas Crooks in Sheffield would operate around those three levels of interaction, and it would be very much the small group for intimacy and support and accountability, a middle-sized group that would be task and mission-oriented, and that would be their identity, and the third group would be celebratory, and perhaps teaching on a larger scale. So there are other models that that are and St. Thomas Crook's a very interesting one, I think, because out of that has also come the order for mission, which allows people to sign up for a very disciplined approach to being engaged in mission, both here and elsewhere, but with almost a missionary order, a recovering of the notion of the missionary order. I should have mentioned that as well, because that's a very significant movement.
Yes. I guess one of the reasons that the congregation has come to be is to do with the efficiency of teaching and cohesion and everything else that goes with that. There must have been something in the fact of people going to the trouble of getting together the finances and the organisational structures that would support those kind of buildings, etc., etc., that come with the congregation. Where do we go with teaching and developing an understanding of scriptures in a congregational church, in a non-congregational church model?
I think the emphasis moves from direct teaching to looking at learning styles. I think it's a different question, actually. People often ask us around the Raven community, where's your teaching? And I would say, well, we don't really have any, but we've learned a lot, you know. And there wasn't a direct, there really wasn't direct teaching. And I say that actually partly joking, but also quite serious, because I have also for 6 years now, seven years, been meeting every fortnight with two businessmen at lunchtime. And we just meet in one of their offices and we just talk about the issues of business and family and church and all those interactions. And I sometimes think about those two men, and if I was thinking of myself in terms of my teaching role, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we were to say that while we've all mutually, you know, supported one another, if I was talking about my role, I reckon that those folks will have gained more from me through those times of life-related conversation than through some of the other teaching things that I have done over that same period. So, I think that takes me back, you see. I think one of the things about, I think of Jesus and his approach to teaching, his discipleship pattern can be summed up in six words. It was take, teach, test, take, teach, trust. He took people with him, and then he taught them on the way by telling stories and asking questions. And then he gave them a test run, you know, Luke 10, Matthew 10, have a go. And when you can heal the sick and raise the dead, we'll take you on to the advanced class, you know. And then he took them on to the facing the cross stuff. And he started teaching about that. And, of course, they just couldn't get their heads around that at all. But he took them, you see, all the way to the cross. And only once he had taken them to the cross and come through the other side of the resurrection, could say, now you know, you know where it leads and what God can do. Now I can trust you to go and win the world. And I think what we tend to do and what we have tended to do is teach, 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 and hope for the best. And so we've taken the relational element out of the taking, of the apprenticing, of the gathering, and those tests, those testing places for people. And so I think there may be a kind of review of what we mean by teaching that is to be considered within there, within that question. And it may be that part of that is in those multiple layers that we've talked about. There is a place for the kind of clear exposition, and we have folks here who are excellent at being able to lay things out in an orderly way that I can see that. That's very helpful. So there is that capacity for that that's important. But I just wonder if we have again put too many eggs in one particular basket as far as that particular approach is concerned.
Could I ask a question, Peter, about it seems to me that the church as we see it in the New Testament is a heterogeneous body, and that what we are witnessing today is a kind of outbreak of that that element, these elements of difference in the church, and that the danger, as I see it, is that we all go for a niche church, whether we like a control, like to control or be controlled, or whether we like to do our own thing. And what seems to me we need to work for is to bring that point where Paul says in Corinth, the whole church comes together, and it's uniting this together. One thing that concerns me, I'm reading Eddie Gibbs' book on the emerging church at the moment, is how critical the people he's interviewing are of the charismatic movement, the mega churches, the mainline churches, and dismissive. You know, that anything other than emergent is somehow rather dismissed. And I know that that's probably the newness of the experience, but my fear is that we're going to disintegrate when we really need to consolidate and come together. And rather than my being dismissive of the emerging church or they being dismissive of me, I think we have to learn from one another and demonstrate, you know, to the world our unity. Would you like to reflect on that?
Yeah, as Graham Cray says, we can't. We can't build the church on the angst of Gen X, and I think there's a lot in that, and there is a I think the negative identity question you're raising, and I read all that stuff too, and I heard the pain, I heard the hurt, I heard the anger, and I was very aware of that, you know. I think that's liminality. I think that's they will move through that, but. What I don't think we can do, is short circuit that, in other words, kind of pull people back in to where we've been. I think we've got to journey together through to another place. And Stuart Murray, in his book on Church After Christendom, he moves us beyond Acts chapter 10, which a lot of us have looked at in terms of the call of the spiritual searcher and the new patterns of engagement with the searcher, to Acts 11, where the story's told to the church in Jerusalem, in a sense. And he actually says, this is actually a meeting of friends. This is not a hostile gathering. This is a meeting of friends, of those who have been kind of back home at the ranch and the people that are coming in from the frontiers. And he actually holds that out as the model of those part of what we might call the kind of inherited pattern of church life, and those engaging in the front line of the emerging culture. And keeping that conversation alive is important. I would say one of the things that we tried to do that in terms of the Raven community with St. Cuthbert's, and we achieved that to a measure, to a degree, but I sometimes regret that we didn't press that a wee bit further, I think. So I think I agree, keeping the conversation going. I do fear the power dynamic that pulls everything, as it were, kind of back into line, that sees this just as a little anomaly that will just, you know, come back into line. You're not saying that, but I nonetheless hear that in other places that try to pull things back in, rather than say there is something here that may really be signs that we all have to listen to, and again, picking up the opening question from Howard, that will actually stimulate the settled church to become the movement again. And if it does that, then we're onto something. But if it's the pullback, then we will lose an awful lot. I think there may be other ways of heterogeneity. I think the other assumption has been that we see it even around churches that have a range of different worship patterns, within one congregation, and there's a kind of feeling that we should all be in the one place at the one time doing the one thing, when I think the patterns of togetherness may actually be around meals, or it may be around some shared projects that we undertake together. We will retain our together and have occasional times when worship may be the place where we recognise we worship the one God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and we come together. But I don't think that will always be the integration point. Mm-hmm. So be finding other ways of keeping the relatedness and the conversation going.
Does that make sense? It takes a long time to do that, Peter.
Yeah.
I think that some of the discussion about emerging church, to me, is and some of the polarisations over it, are very similar to the discussions and the polarizations of the emergence of the charismatic
in the 70s.
In the 1960s.
Yes. Sure.
And
I was in London when it just all went bang, and immediately it was like this. And so then both sides were saying, well, you know, we're the church and they're not. And then here's these new groups emerging and saying, well, we're the ones who've got it and, you know, everything else is, the Lord's taken the candlestick away and all that kind of stuff. Well, they wouldn't say candlestick because that was old language, but you know what I mean. And I think we really are in danger of the same thing. I you know, it's taken 40 years for many parts of that divide to have civilized conversation and are still reluctant often to work together. Are we facing another 40 years with this? That's one question, because you know, to me the urgency is, you say, well, yes, heterogeneity was that question? And how do we must hold the conversation? I guess my question is, how do you actually facilitate that conversation with grace and truth together? Evangelicals are not good at keeping grace and truth together. You know, some one way and some the other way, but not together. So that to me is a very urgent question. The other thing, and my elder son spent 8 years on the staff of St. Thomas Crooks and is one of the leaders of the Order of Mission. So I've been following this conversation and watching what they've been doing and comparing it with some of what has happened in East Asia, which is my real world.
Yes.
And one of the things I think that the emerging church has to think about, and these small groups have to think about, is how do they have, you know, you can meet in your pub and you can meet around your question, what's happened this week? But at what point is there biblical input? See, what happened with the charismatic movement when it started was that all those guys who started those different groups, most of them had come out of brethren backgrounds, found that their dispensationalism
didn't connect
their spiritual experience, so they started charismatic streams. I mean, that's a gross generalization.
I know what you mean.
But they had a lot of biblical background.
Yes.
And then the second generation didn't have that.
Yep. Yeah.
And there's trouble. So in the same way, some of these little groups, I have enormous sympathy, but my fear is, how do you get biblical input into that? And when I look, say, at what has happened in the church in China, where because it's had to be like that often outside TSPM, you have all these little groups, and you have more heresies and cults. Then you can even begin to number. And how do we prevent that happening? Do you see what I mean? So I have these two big questions about how, you know, it can be too fuzzy to say, well, you're traveling with Jesus. I was talking last night with somebody who talked about traveling with Jesus, but actually doesn't believe in the resurrection, doesn't X, Y, and Z. And I think, do we really want to go down that? What happens a generation later?
I've asked myself that question. I don't think I have an answer for it, Rose, but I do recognise the issue of that many of the folks who are raising the questions at the moment don't realise how much of a legacy they've already received and what and the spiritual capital they're actually running off. So I think I would simply recognise that.
But I want to go beyond that and say, how can we sympathise with those who want to do something different in order to engage people who won't be engaged by our congregation?
That's right.
I don't believe our congregations are the church. I think they are one manifestation
of
the church.
That's right.
So how do we sympathise with that, but yet encourage that input from Scripture? That means that there will be faithfulness coming out of them.
Have you got an answer for that from your own missionary experience? I mean, it would help us with that, because you're talking of what would you have liked to have seen happen that would have avoided some of the fragmentation you've described from the Chinese experience. Were there any places where that was avoided? Are there lessons to be learned?
Well,
there?
Well, I think the Chinese situation has been exacerbated by the fact that many of the house churches don't have access to scripture.
So it's not no access, yes.
But then I see some of these little disciple groups. I talked with groups in New Zealand of people who've come out of the churches. It has this huge exodus from the church. In London, a lot of people who have come out the back door of the churches, including the Afro-Caribbean churches and the Prosperity Gospel churches, out the back door. And actually, there is biblical illiteracy there, even though they might have... it isn't internalized, if you see what I mean. So just saying, well, there are Bibles floating around, how do you actually build into it that kind of real study of the scriptures?
One of the things that I have thought about is if they didn't have the whole Bible, now this you can throw me out when I say this. But if they didn't have the whole Bible, what would I give them? Because you know, it's almost what's the mini Bible that would actually be essential for people today? And if I was to do an edited version, just keep digging, Nielsen. Just keep digging. Well, what I would be going for, I would go for obviously the Gospels, whatever. Maybe the Gospel of Luke, I think, would be a kind of starter actually for me. I would go for. I don't say it just because her's sitting there, but I do. I saw the smile. I would go for the Psalms to teach people to pray. And again, not just because Ferguson, but I do think that in a world that's talking about spirituality, this is the spirituality that brings the whole of life before the whole of God all the time. And I think that would give people that as their model for prayer. I think the wisdom literature then gives you around that, whether it's Job and suffering, whether it's Proverbs and the practical business of decisions that are life giving or destructive, you know, I think there's stuff there that people can get a hold of and say this would actually help me if John Drain is right, the people they're looking for, the how to. I think there's a task of taking literally the book of Proverbs and offering that as a kind of manual for living. I would want to give people Ephesians. I think because Ephesians is for me the is just soaking people in the grace of God. And what people need. Romans was the great Reformation document because everyone was loaded up with medieval guilt. So Romans was the great release. I think in our world of low self-esteem, of lack of self-worth, where guilt actually isn't really an issue, but meaning is, lack of affirmation, lack of trust, I think the affirmation of Ephesians is astonishing. And what it says when I read that cascade of grace at the beginning, I would soak people in that, which both tells people who they are and what they can become, and what you know, and all the lifestyle issues that are there as well in the second part of it. And interestingly, the other thing that I would give people, and this was had this conversation with John Drain actually recently, and I was telling him my little kind of mini Bible, and he said, and I would throw in Revelation. And you know, I think he's right. The reason is because it's almost as bizarre as real life. It's because people are so anxious about global issues. That is the one book that offers a book that offers a kind of sense of global reach in it that would say, yeah, the thing is absolute chaos, but actually, you know, God's still got a hold on this. this whole messy business. And you can add the selection, but that's where I would come from. I would have people read the Gospels, I have them pray the Psalms, I would have them into Proverbs, soak them in Ephesians, and I would say, just at least read the beginning, and if you only read the last chapter of Revelation, it'll keep you going. I know that it turns out good.
So did you do that with the Raven Group?
No, we didn't do that with that intensity. We didn't do that, and that I think would have been the next stage to come to, and I think our group dispersed. And I'm glad you've asked, but it came out of asking. What I would do in that group, and we started doing, we tended to do more round table than intentional. When we were doing some of the more intentional stuff, I think this kind of control power stuff was very difficult to deal with. And I mentioned along the way there that I was aware of issues for me of diffidence in leadership, and I'm not sure whether I may actually have been more diffident than I should have been in that situation, because I didn't want to be imposing. And I think coming at it again, I think it would be less diffident. I hope I would not, I would still be humble about it, but I would not be as diffident about making those kind of suggestions. So I'm grateful for the question. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very, very much. If we get the Nielsen canon, the Bible Society's work will be much simpler. But the point that Rose makes is a very interesting one. A lot of the translation agencies now, rather than translating, you know, say the Gospel of Mark or whatever as their first go, are selecting texts from key texts in the biblical story, 48 texts.
Right.
And they are finding that there's, as a result of that, when people get the outline, there's much less confusion and much less heretical teaching. It's very interesting.
Yeah, so they get the...
They get the storyline.
They get the narrative.
Yeah, yeah, they get the narrative. Peter, thank you very much. That was very, very helpful, very stimulating. Thank you very much indeed. We look forward to more after we have our tea and coffee. Do we go over... So we actually have to go. It's salvation by works. Before you go, could I remind you that tomorrow we have an open forum, and that you know, you're invited to make a short contribution if you've read a book that is interesting or an issue that you would like to raise. We don't want a sermon. We don't want any more than 10 minutes, but it's an opportunity for us to bring some of our own concerns to one another. So thank you. Thank you very much, Peter. We'll thank you more formally at the end of the afternoon. But we follow not Moses, but David.